thatsthenorm.com. Yanis Dimitrilas is the marketer, the riser, and a brother in the pursuit of wisdom. He is the Anti-Fool. Welcome to the Anti-Fool Podcast. This is where we deconstruct the wisdom of people from all fields, backgrounds, and walks of life. My role is simple. I play the fool, I ask the questions, and you get the answers. Our guest is the Anti-Fool, the source of wisdom who we will learn from today. I'm on a mission to create the antidote to foolishness, so we can understand the world and ourselves better. Wonderful stuff, right? So, shall we? And in this episode, we have someone very interesting and very varied in his experience. Yanis Dimitrilas is an expert in marketing, currently leading a content marketing team based in the Netherlands. He's done quite a number of marketing consulting work, been part of a team to sell chocolate all around the world, and most of all, he is a good friend. We've known each other ever since, shall we say, 2007. So that's like 13, 14 years, which we'll bring up in the episode. And I knew from seeing his journey online, on social media, how he's been doing, how he's been deconstructing, reconstructing himself, that there's going to be some amazing wisdom to be heard from him when I have this chat. So we talked about vulnerability. We talked about finding your why. We talked about cultures and being a cross-cultural kid. We talked about all the different observations we have of the world. It's quite a number of things. The topics have varied. And those are the kinds of conversations that I really like. So I really do appreciate Yanis for being an awesome person to talk to. Without further ado, here is my chat with Yanis Dimitrilas. All right, Yanis, how are you?
What's up? How's it going?
Are you goddamn ready?
I'm goddamn ready. This is going to be exciting.
Oh, God.
You nervous?
A little bit. I'm fucking sleepy. That's the first thing.
True. What time is it over there? Like 5 a.m?
Yeah, it's 5. Oh, God. Woke up an hour ago and I just came back from like an event talking about religious freedom in media. So there's like 2 hours of people discussing over like serious ways to make sure journalism is free and different ways that all these like different factors are happening where what is minimizing people's voices or like what should we do? Do we change the business model or blah blah blah? And I didn't contribute shit. And it's not that I didn't have anything to say. I did from a podcasting standpoint. The thing is, everybody at the table was a writer or a journalist. I'm not a journalist. The most that I do is I reach out to people and I say, hey, let's talk, and we record it. But I guess that counts. I don't know.
But a learning experience either way. And I guess you're around all these people who have a big influence and have a big voice like within that community. So don't necessarily take it as like, hey, I didn't say something that makes me less so. It's more like, oh, hey, there was a lot of voices in there that had far more value to bring. And as long as you absorb their message, like, yeah, you're good. Just take it away, learn from it, and like use that in your own work.
Yeah, I just went in there quiet and I just learned. Pretty much only speak when necessary. I think that works the best when you're in meetings with so many people that are much more intelligent and smarter than you. And the best way for you to gain something from that experience is just to shut the hell up.
No, I definitely agree with that. I've seen the value of that too, where you just shut the hell up and just listen for a while. Yeah. Like, it's hard, and most people have no idea how to do it. The moment you do learn how to do it, like, you can seriously get a lot of value out of the room.
Why do we do it? Why do you think so?
I mean, the thing is that most people, when they're having that discussion, they're like, they've already got an answer in their head. So you're not waiting to really listen to the question or the statement that the other person is making. You're like impatiently waiting to respond. And so because of that, what happens is you just have this like ongoing chase conversation of like, oh, like, when's it my turn? When's it my turn? And actually, in the end, if you decide to be selfless in that way and to just say, hey, look, actually, you know what? Like, floor is yours. Tell me what you can give me. You get a lot of people who acknowledge that and really come out of their shell and really share things that you wouldn't otherwise learn or wouldn't otherwise hear. And sometimes giving people that space actually empowers them in a way that you might never have seen before.
That's really fascinating. And I feel that that kind of skill isn't really, I call it a skill because it can be trained, or at least it can be embedded in someone. Communication skills from a point of view where you sit back and allow, you know, civil discussion, or you sit back and absorb what the person is saying, from their phrasing to their tonality to their nonverbal cues to what they're actually saying, right? Or why are they saying it, right? From their context, why they're speaking that opinion, or at least if you take it in a very, what's the phrase for it? You walk a mile in their shoes and understand why they've said it that way. I wish we learned that in school, because I don't know about you, I mean, I didn't really learn it.
Like my criticism for that statement and that phrase is to walk a mile in someone else's shoes assumes that you can really understand exactly what someone else is feeling. And sometimes it is a case that there are situations that there is simply no way for you to like really grasp what this other person has been through, or, you know, like what their thought process is, or, and so actually sometimes it's just letting them walk their shoes. It's just letting them like truly get down and not making any assumptions, not like setting upon them your expectations. It's really seeing them for who they are and acknowledging them for who they are, but also letting them tell their story in their own way, like giving them the platform to do that. And I mean, I say all these things, but it's been very, very hard to even really acknowledge what that means, and even harder now to like put it into practice.
Have you done that recently? Was there like a recent experience where you were trying to understand someone and the best that you could do was by observing that experience? I've had that happen recently with someone who went to Japan as to teach English, and she was sexually assaulted in her own accommodation.
Oh my God.
By housemates, yeah. Right? Now, there's a limit to how much we can empathize, or, you know, reach out to say, hey, I'm here for you. But, you know, is that what they really want, or is that what they need, right? Do they need space to heal? What about her level of emotional intelligence? Like, is she capable of recovering on her own? In this case, she is. I know her really well. But I would freeze up in that kind of situation, right?
Yeah.
There's only so much. Yeah.
In the end, in that situation, like what I find the most valuable is being that person that they can reach out to when they need, and not like impose yourself. And I mean, I say all this like I'm not an expert. There's definitely like far more trained people who have better approaches. Yeah. But in the most situations, like these people need help, and be a platform that they can reach out to and support them in any way you can. And I think, like, not on such a serious case, but in other cases, like much less, where a very, very vulnerable situation came up for someone, and in most situations they were unwilling to share because they felt that too many people would impose, or they would say certain things, or they would, like, you know, say the usual phrases like, oh, I'm so sorry that happened. Like, oh, yeah, you know, like all that stuff. But actually, in the end, all they need is just that room to express themselves. And I think by giving this person that, it did help them a lot. And it was just a case, you know, you just sit there, you just listen, you ask the questions. Maybe even you don't ask the questions, but you clearly show you're paying attention. And sometimes that in itself is already super cathartic for them. And it just gives them this impression of a safe space, which I know in my life has played a huge role when people have done the same for me. And so it's a small sacrifice to do that for somebody else.
When was the biggest moment in your life that having that kind of feeling played a role?
I mean, I'd say probably like towards the end of my time in London. So I left London at the end of 2018. and decided to move back to the Netherlands. And
that's
it was
for uni,
a case...
right?
No. So I had been working in London for some time, like 2.5 years then. But towards the end of that stint, it just wasn't really where I wanted to be, you know, like from a, you know, mental health perspective, from just like a fitting in perspective, it wasn't the place that I should have been anymore. And through that, someone sat me down at some point and we had just one of these like really intimate chats of, hey, where is it exactly you want to go? What is it you want to do? And even having that discussion and sitting down with someone and just being like, hey, actually, you know what? Like, I've been toiling with this for a long time. You know, I've been trying to push it. Sometimes you say, I'll hustle through it. Oh, yeah, like if you make it over the mountain, suddenly there'll be grass on the other side that's so much greener than here.
Mm.
But it just wasn't pulling through. It just wasn't happening. And it was just this moment of, you know, like where it just clicks, where the realization just comes in. And it was that space that someone gave me to just, you know, talk it through, like consider my thoughts, add a bit of like perspective here and there, that really just came to the realization of, yeah, I think it's time. I think it's time for me to get out of here. And actually that has proved to be possibly the best decision I've ever made. Like coming back to the Netherlands was honestly one of the single greatest decisions I've made in my life.
Did you think that you could reach that revelation on your own?
I think you can. I'm not going to rule out that it's impossible to do it without other people.
Yeah.
But I think it takes a hell of a lot of self-awareness. I think it takes a hell of a lot of like self-confidence to really believe in yourself to that degree where you say, you know what? Fuck yeah, this is me. This is exactly what I'm going to do. I know that I don't have that. It's something that I've seen in other people that I admire to no end, to have that sense of courage that, you know, even if it doesn't work out, it'll work out in the end. And those are the kinds of people that you're more likely to see that independent choice making, where they really say like, hey, let me assess where I am right now and where I can go. And let's see what happens.
So I call those inspirational figures, right? Or heroes. Yeah. They span across many different sources of what knowledge or from your network or from your friends. I see, at least from how I've been living my life in various countries, I'm sure you've had this as well, from moving from place to place. There is a hero in pretty much every corner of the planet. And they have their own problems, their own issues. But the way that they do some self-introspection, the way that they assess their thoughts, the way that they recognize certain negative influences in their lives and they take action on it, right? We have this way to essentially accept the inconveniences in our lives and say like, hey, you know, it sucks, but I'm going to push through it because it's what I've been used to. And we have a lot of excuses to basically justify that where I am right now is better than where I could be if I were to try. Do you have anyone in mind when it comes to someone inspiring?
I mean, I find it so interesting that you're saying this like culture that we grew up in, that like traveling reveals so many people, because that's exactly how I feel about it. It's not single individuals and it's not a certain characteristic, I would say, like just thinking of how to say this in the best way. It's not like a single type of character, but there is like a uniting factor between all of these people. So there's one person that I know who's not necessarily like a close friend of mine, but he's always someone that I've admired from a distance. So he is now like a young filmmaker based in New Zealand who is basically just been like committed to creating these like really positive environments and really positive spaces for people. And it was always something that you could just see that he's like radiating happiness or radiating joy, even though he's on several occasions, he's very much admitted, like he has this internal shakiness, insecurity about where he's going and what he's doing. But in the end, it's that mission of, hey, if I succeed with this, the world's a better place in some way. I mean, it's a noble thing to say, but actually in the end, you really feel that energy coming from him, and you really feel like he's one of those people who can carry that charisma and that. Another person that really springs to mind is an old friend of ours, Adrian Santiago.
Ah, yes.
who is, for me, is possibly the single bravest person I've met.
Why?
In the sense of, like, he knows, I won't say he knows where he wants to go, but he absolutely has no bars hold, or what's the expression there, like, doesn't hold back on anything. Like, he's willing to try anything and everything. He has no, like, in my sense, no expectations, and just delivers on what he says. Like, he's a man of his word, and it's something that you really admire, because he can combine this, like, really, he's a really intelligent person, but he combines it together with this, like, just selflessness for other people and this ambition, which is, in my opinion, unmatched.
Yeah, at least from, well, when we met up in London, like, 2 years ago, I believe.
Yeah.
That you were pretty much giving your side, how you've been. And I asked about others, and I asked about Adrian. Adrian, if you're listening to this, how are you doing? So there's a difference. You might have seen this in other people. The best way to truly see someone's character is to hear how they are from somebody else's perspective. Because when I asked you about Adrian, you had this, like, interesting fire in your eyes. You were like, yeah, he's doing this, and he's going to this place, and he's surfing, and while doing his master's. I don't remember the exact story, but I remember it was something like that. It's pretty fascinating. Mm-hmm. But the enthusiasm in you when you were describing him, it's really reflective of how infectious ambition can be, or how infectious enthusiasm can be, or this, like, conviction to be so sure about what you're going to do in life.
But it's also that I've seen, like, another variation of it. And I think this is also something to bear in mind when you're talking about these kind of people, because it's not necessarily pure ambition. I think it's also just combined with a realism. It's like, it's humble, yet it's ambitious. It's, like, balanced in the sense of, like, you're doing all the reviews, you're, like, understanding exactly, like, where you're sitting in reality. You're selfless to other people, but at the same time, you balance that out with a really, really high expectation of what's possible. And so you bring people along for the journey rather than running for yourself.
Like, that's, like, an example of, like, really amazing life experience, right? How would you design a school that can harness that, bring that to, like, kids of the next generation? I've always wondered that, because right now we're seeing a huge change in, like, online education, like, shifts in business models where people are learning in their own pace. I've seen these predictions, which are really fascinating, right? We have a lot of information already in our hands. We can easily just Google them, and we can easily just search them. But the shift in business models for people trying to learn something, whether it's self-development, whether it's a technical skill, it's not the content itself, it's the community around it, right? The accountability and the ability to bounce assumptions, break them down, deconstruct them, and then build something that's more sure and be more confident in yourself, because you are now in an environment where you can learn something. Now, how would you teach that?
I mean, there's a lot of research, and there's a lot of books that I've been reading, like, not necessarily around this topic, but like, specifically the kinds of ways that they're trying to build upon that. And I think it really comes down to, where is the value in education? Like, what is it exactly you're trying to get out of the system? Are you trying to test people so that they can pass an exam so they can get out? Or are you trying to make them, like, productive members? Because I think truly your own confidence comes from being able to visibly see for yourself that you can add something to someone's life in some shape or form. It's the whole thing of, like, yeah, a lot of the reasons why, like, some people in vulnerable positions go into crime is because it gives them a satisfaction. It gives them, you know, like a value that they did not have before. And it's the same thing with schools. And there's a lot of cases where you have schools where kids actually design their own learning, like, which seems like a really out there concept, but it is that they have full control over how they grow, which areas they grow into, you know, whether they're better at writing, whether they're better at, you know, maths, like they can specialize in those things much, much earlier on. And of course they still need to cover like base subjects, but it is that acknowledgement of their talents, which gives them the confidence and the, you know, the connection to other people because they are genuinely being listened to. And I feel like that's something that, whether it's in schools, whether it's in work, whether it's in, you know, like walking down the street, feeling listened to is possibly the most important feeling that you can get in order to build that, hey, I connect to other people. Hey, like I am actually someone of value. Hey, I can bring some happiness to somebody else's life. And from there, the schools will grow. Like how you capture that, I have no idea. But that is the feeling. That's the feeling you need to get when you go to a place like that.
When has listening opened doors for you?
Yeah, I think, for example, in my current role, it's been a huge lesson because now I manage a team of five, which is a very, very new experience for me, that I went from kind of being the managed one to now being this position of responsibility where listening, in my opinion, and from all the books that I've read and all the management stuff that I've seen of good practice, listening is like the critical factor for it. If I don't listen to these people, if I don't give them a chance to express themselves in a way that they want, in a way that they feel acknowledged and have their ideas at least like considered to some degree, I lose their energy. I lose their I lose their passion. I lose their like intelligence, their commitment, their like, I pretty much lose them as individuals. And so for me, that's been a huge opportunity because actually the more that I listen to them, the more that I give them the platform to do everything that I know that they can do, and they surprise me too, the more that I give them that space, the more that they show actually what they're capable of, and great things happen. It's something very new to me because I've never been, or at least like never been in such a position of, I'll say like feeling responsible for others. And I guess it's also that I the only thing I've realized is I have so much more to learn on this space of like really thinking about how you're saying things to people. Like, are you listening to how they're feeling today? Are you listening to, you know, some of the stuff that's going on at home? Like, can you pay attention to notice those types of things? And so really what I've seen is listening in this new role of mine opens them. It opens them to do great things. And so now my big challenge is keeping my mouth shut sometimes because I am a big word person. I'm someone that likes to talk. I'm someone who likes to convey that energy too. But taking that step back is a big step that I need to make to really get the best out of them, but also to give them the freedom to express who they are.
The balance between you being able to lead and you being able to hold, pull back and then allow them to thrive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that reflective of your experience being managed?
Like, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
The people that I admire most that I've worked with have always been the ones who gave me the space, but gave me the safety net just as much. And those are the truly... Yeah, like I value them a lot. They played a huge role, and now I still keep them around as mentors and ask them questions all the time because actually they showed me exactly the example that I want to follow and that I want to demonstrate to other people. They really opened doors for me by doing so. But not only that, they also show you that you can do way more than you thought. I mean, what is it? There's several. I mean, people that I get, yeah. Generally, like I've seen that, I've also seen the opposite, which is, you know, people that I just don't connect with for whatever reason. And that's difficult too. And there, that takes a certain level of patience, maturity, to be able, which I'll be honest, I was not ready to, like, let's say, cope with in the way that I would have liked. But now that I look back in retrospect, I know that that was something that I needed to experience so that I can learn and do exactly what I know so well and why I think it's so important.
It sounds like you've been on the fast track to learning such uncomfortable situations, which is great.
But you only get that from leaning in, right? If you play safe, you'll never be in those positions. And I want to say that I'm leaning in. I don't feel like I've taken every opportunity that's come my way, but I do think the ones that do land in front of me, I go all in.
This was from your time in London, right? So that was, yeah. I don't know if we can name drop them, say, specific.
No, let's not name drop them. But,
I mean, look, the thing, chocolate brand. Shall we leave it at that?
The thing is, look, I stand by that. I really admire what they've created as a company. I really admire the people that I worked with. Like, there was a lot of people who were great, who were really, really intelligent, who were really, like, committed to what they were doing. I knew that my time was up, in the sense of, like, there were other factors outside of work that I wasn't happy with, but it was just as well that, you know, where you stop seeing that growth that maybe you're accustomed to, that there was quite a rapid expansion in the sense of my own career and where I wanted to go. And I got held up by maybe myself, maybe by circumstances, doesn't really matter. But in the end, I knew that it was time for me to go. And actually, that was a very, very good decision, because that opened up a very, very successful year afterwards of more free thinking, more independent thinking, and some greater connections that really opened some other doors that were very, very interesting and very, like, even more learnings than what I had before.
Let's talk about that phase in between. Because I know that I was reaching out to you while you were working at said chocolate company. And after that, you went off to your own path. And on the transition to, I think, if I remember, correct me if I'm wrong, that you were still in London for a while. And then you moved back to Holland, to Netherlands. And you had a workshop on finding your why. And also, there was that one video that you did. There was a video of you doing a talk. I believe it's like having a life as an adventure. I believe that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, talk to me about that. Yeah.
So to give you a bit of context, like, towards the end of, like, as I'd already given my notice and was doing my, like, 3 months notice for the end of the company, I signed up for this speaking course, so Speak Up Challenge. It's like a big company based in the UK that does a lot of, like, coaching for public speaking, that type of thing.
Oh, nice.
And that was really an amazing opportunity to explore this idea I had of exactly what I was living at that time. Is sometimes life just needs you to jump. You have no idea where it's going to end up. You have no idea what it's going to be like. You might not necessarily enjoy it, but you will regret the fact that you did it. And so that talk was really kind of the culmination. It finished, what was it? It was like beginning of December. I left London at the end of December. So it really just kind of came at just the right time with the right kind of, like, spirit and energy to send me off into the new year. Then as soon as I arrived back, I got in touch with some old friends who are based here. And that suddenly opened up doors, because I got involved with this startup based here in Holland called Tensail. So Tensail is basically a company that's created a patent for a new type of tent structure, particularly for festivals. Uses, like, essentially a new building type of material. Like, because of the tension, it's much more stable, stays up in, like, higher wind speeds, that kind of thing. Yeah, it was a fantastic opportunity. I got to learn from, again, like, another hero of mine. Yeah, Floris was also, like, a huge, huge help in kind of bringing my spirits up and opening all these doors for me, and got me straight involved in his own operation together with Arto. And I got to be a big part of them in their chase for the Philips Innovation Award, which is a very, very, like, prestigious award for startups here in the Netherlands. So we did the semifinal together. And then we got through to the final, which was amazing. Like, we had Flores up on the TV screens, which was amazing. And then we just missed out the prize in the end. But either way, the fact that we were there, the fact that we were getting coached by some of the biggest companies in the world that were so happy to give us so much advice and so much like of their time, was already one of these eye-opening moments of, wow, people are really building incredible things and people are really taking enormous risks and seeing them pay off in some way or another. And that ultimately led to us building the first ever 10 Sail 10 at a festival here in the Netherlands into the Great Wide Open. So we got to build it up ourselves. We got to, like, you know, pull ropes. We got to set up. It was amazing. It was just being a part of someone else's dream kind of come to life, and so much hard work and so much like pursuing everything and so much trouble finally came into a piece of reality. And then alongside that, through that confidence that being part of that project gave me, I basically started doing some work as a freelancer, doing marketing strategy for small businesses. It was a case of being around a couple of entrepreneurs who were starting up in The Hague, where we were having small discussions, and it was really a case of, wow, I can really provide you with something that's useful. I can really give you something that can help your business out, that can give you some, like, you know, a boost forward in the direction that you want to go. And so I did a few projects here and there for small businesses that really kind of brought into perspective, yeah, my philosophy and philosophy that I've learned from like Simon Sinek and all these people of how important it is to have a purpose at the center of your business. What is it all worth? Like, why are you bothering doing this at all? And why should anyone believe you? Without that, everything goes to shit. And it was so important to be able to see how that resonated with people, how forgotten sometimes it is, through all the chaos, through all the hustle, through all the like meetings and whatever, and whoever you're like chasing to do, sometimes that's the one thing that goes by the wayside, and it's the one thing that shouldn't. And so that was a big revelation. Got to do two or three projects, got to work together with a really, really good friend of mine who's based in New York, he's basically made his own agency called DeliSign. And what he does is he kind of marries together technology and design. And we got to work on a couple of things together as well, which was amazing. And really to help him to grow. I think he just won an award from some of the copywriting that I was doing for him. But it was just, yeah, like showing what I can do and feeling a value from, yeah, like, I know my shit. I can do something. I might not be the best at it, but I'm definitely like, I could definitely do this. And so that was what brought me back into marketing and back into this kind of like energetic self that I know that I had. And then the opportunity came up to work for the company that I work for now as this manager of a team of five. And that's more in like the digital marketing space, like more around search engine optimization. But it's great. It's just been like seeing your learning just, you know, pick up speed. You've gone from like gear one to gear five like in the space of a few months. And it's been so rewarding and it's been great for everything. Literally my life like turned around in the last year.
But all this happened in the span of a few months.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
So I think from January, I was doing like some studying at home. By March, we were doing Tencel stuff. And then by June, we were like tents on fire type of thing.
Oh, my goodness.
It was wild. It's still like, it doesn't seem real how fast it all went.
Wait, let's break down a bit about that. So yeah. I have no clue about, I'm going to play the fool a little bit here. I know nothing about the tent structure industry, right? This is such a specific industry and I have no clue. I'm assuming there's like some level of architecture or material design or material sciences involved.
I have to say, when I started, I had no idea either. So that was, I think that was the most fascinating thing about it, which is, I was walking into a market that I knew nothing about and had mostly interacted with like consumer products, as you mentioned, like chocolate and all that, but I'd never been to this level of like such a huge creation. We were super fortunate to pair up with this company called Innifest, who essentially is a grant-funded organization that gives the space to entrepreneurs to really test their ideas for the first time in a festival setting. And that was a huge door opener for the guys with this tent. And then through them, they connected us basically to a number of festivals around the Netherlands. We got to pitch the idea a couple of times. We went to some talks. And that was really how the door opened for us to have serious discussions about where it could go and what it could do and whether it was real or not. For me, my part was mostly on the visuals, on the presentations. Like, we worked on the pitch like numerous times. We were presenting it over and over and over and over again. But it was really about giving them like the professionalism I think they had and making that a visual that they could work with. And I think now that's really given them something to use going forwards as much as they want.
How are they doing now, actually?
Yeah, honestly, they're great.
Awesome.
Now they're doing some research to see what like the next design is, how far they can get with the current one that you have in storage at the moment. But really it's a company that I think has future. I think it has a lot more growth to go. And they have proof of concept that this actually works, that it's something that stands. It does handle some weather. We need to see how much weather it stands. There are some improvements that are needed to take it to the next level, but I have full faith in them. I know that they can do it. I know that what they have is solid. And yeah, I'm curious to see where it goes in the future.
I'm going to see these tents in Coachella. That'd be freaking amazing.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that would be awesome, wouldn't it? That's a discussion. When you start seeing them in like really legitimate places, then I'll be the one, like, you'll see me with the tears already. Yeah. there's no doubt.
My boys, I'm so proud of you.
yeah, exactly.
Unless it's Fire Festival, then you're...
No.
Then you're sort of fucked.
the only thing keeping it going.
And earlier you said that after your brief time in Tensale, you started to do projects for smaller businesses. And you did bring up something that piqued my interest. You said that these actions were reflective of your philosophy. And I guess by specifically saying that phrase, you really were introspecting on that period of time, those last few months, or maybe even all the experience culminating in London for the last few years. And as you came back to Netherlands, this opportunity came upon.
Yeah.
I want to ask, what is your philosophy?
So I think the best way to describe my philosophy is that everyone should feel happy with what work they're doing. I think that's probably the best like summary thing that I can give. I think a lot of the work, like Simon Sinek for me is a huge inspirational figure. I think he and his work, like Start With Why and Leaders Eat Last and all of that, for me, that is exactly the way that I want to see, like, if I have my own teams, my teams run, my company run, the companies that I work for run. That is the mentality that I want to see. I think, for example, like, the majority of companies that became great is usually because they started like that and then grew out of that mentality. And that's why you have people who are frustrated about big corporate and big whatever. Like, you can't tell me that, for example, Disney didn't grow up on the magic, like the magical feeling of seeing princesses and seeing this story come to life in front of you. That magic is what kept people there. It's what like gives people the life and the joy that they love. And I think there's a lot of people who work there who still feel that. It's, for example, like the Apples in the world, where at a time it was about thinking differently. It was about pushing the boundaries of, you know, connecting people to technology and making beautiful design and all that stuff. Now it's just your next phone and happens to have a big hype culture. And so, yeah, it's a bummer, but in the end, like, that is what I want to do. And I'm really, really proud of small organizations who have the heart to just like stay true to themselves and be passionate for their people and take care of their people, because ultimately it makes them better organizations. And that's a movement that I want to be a part of.
Is there an ideal position that you would love to strive for in the future, where you can make the most of that philosophy yourself?
I don't know. It's something that I'm actually like pondering at the moment. Pondering is a really fancy word. No, that's not the word I want to use. Like, it's something that I'm thinking about, because yeah. I think you can do it from both perspectives as an entrepreneur and as like a business owner. Let's say you have full right to shape your organization in some way in your image or in the image that you want to create. On the other hand, I've seen just as many managers in like large companies, people that I've worked with, people that I see from a distance, who are making that impact in their own way. And not only that, they're shaping their entire organization by having that mentality and showing the results that that mentality can have. I was also reading quite recently about this new type of organizational structure called teal organizations. So I don't know too much about the details because I haven't finished the book yet. But it's this idea of like giving employees the responsibility. So you basically eliminate managers in the sense of a manager. It's like the team manages itself. And the only thing they have is kind of like coaches who coordinate knowledge sharing and all of that. But ultimately you as a team are responsible. So it's like, oh, hey, Norman, like you happen to be better at, I don't know, like content and podcasting, whereas someone else is better at this, but can also do podcasting. Like, you take lead on all of those aspects, even though your experience might be in something else. But at any point in time, I might need you to do like finance work, because I know you have some knowledge somewhere to do that. So ultimately, there's no fixed roles. There's no like structure in the way that you know it. But it's this idea of an assumption that people will do good. It works. It's shown to work for some companies. I don't think it works for everyone. But it's that idea of like responsibility and of like being part of it. I think the more that you feel a part of what you're doing, and the more respected you feel that you're offering something of value, the more you empower the people, the more that they give, the more that, not only if it's like, hey, at some point, if they decide to leave, like, you know, you can't keep people forever. Some people need to grow in other directions. I would much rather be an employer who says, hey, go and follow your dreams. Like, I completely get the reasons why you're doing this. I would much rather see you go with a smile on your face and say, hey, I worked at this place. It gave me all the opportunities and all the, like, opened all the doors that I needed to make this career that I wanted or this life that I wanted. I want to feel proud that I can say that I did that.
That model sounds pretty fascinating. I'm just curious about potential criticisms of it, because I feel that there would be a critical mass before you are assigned defined multiple roles. I can see that happening in a smaller team. So like an agile team of like pre-seed or angel invested team that already has a proof of concept and they already have a few members, you got to wear multiple hats. Sure, it becomes a necessity. But at least from how you're explaining it, it sounds like that is normalized even as you grow or even as you scale.
If you want to find out like a good company who's an example of it, the book that I've been reading uses Burgzorg, which is a Dutch nursing association. They use that as one of the cases of how this model can work. Of, they basically give nurses more time to take care of their patients so that they feel happier, that they understand exactly what their patients' needs are, and are able to not confuse them by constantly having this rotating shift. But it's also that they get to manage their time better. And okay, like there is a bit more responsibility that is, they all say that it's a bit terrifying in the beginning because it kind of feels like you're just dropped into the unknown and you have to figure it out. But ultimately, they have so much control over their own like work that as long as they trust each other and as long as they work effectively together, they ultimately come out with a much better result and a much better quality of care for their patients. So it's worth looking up Burgzorg. No, Burgzorg, that's the one.
Oh, I'm going to have to remember my Dutch. It's been so long I could spell something. Beurtzucht. Okay. All right. Yeah.
So yeah, teal organizations. It's worth a search.
Oh, I've been so obsessed with business models lately, so it's kind of interesting to see that happening.
Yeah, I mean, I need to read the rest of the book, and I'll come back to you once I have all the like the rest of the story, because I've been told the end of the book is the scary part, where it's like, yeah, it doesn't work in these situations. So I'm selling you a dream, but I don't know if the dream is necessarily realistic.
No, I mean, it's nice to look forward to it, like seeing more of that kind of business model pop up, because it's reflective of how workers will fit in, or at least in the future work environment, an employee or a worker, its meaning will be redefined, because you are capable of taking in more responsibility. You are capable of becoming more autonomous, per se, without having a manager over you, or, you know, being like one of those, what do you call them, helicopter moms, like just looking over your shoulder all the time. Yeah. By having that taken out of the equation, it is a pretty interesting filter, right? Some people will not thrive at all in that kind of environment. They need like a professional mom to look over their shoulder and say, hey, you're doing this wrong, or hey, you're doing this right. Sort of like a 9-to-5 mentor, essentially, right? Telling you what to do next, because we deal in absolutes. This one's right, this one's wrong, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, let somebody else hold the responsibility. But in a world where the work environment is changing at such a rapid pace, we have different levels of automation. We have solopreneurs starting up no-code tools, which is basically something I've been obsessed with recently. We have SaaS businesses that are small. They're not large at all. Like, they don't have huge departments. It's just like, what, 10, 15 people? But they're creating amazing products that can be reached from your browser. I'm worried about that. And I'm worried about that because...
Very worried about it.
Because... okay, now you're asking the questions. All right. I'm worried about that on two points. So I'm optimistic and I'm worried about it at the same time. So optimism is that I feel personally that I can fit in that redefined work environment, where by claiming more responsibility over the work that you will do, you will have greater meaning, because you have greater control over the choice of things that you are capable of doing for a mission. You also have the choice of following after a certain mission that you feel aligns with who you are, which is fantastic. It's meaningful. What I'm worried about is to be able to assimilate that into society. More and more people will need to be exposed to that kind of thinking. And it clashes a lot with traditional forms of working, right? We're talking about different generations of people who grew up in 9-to-5 factory jobs. And the term 9-to-5 came from labor manufacturing jobs, because you were measured in output. And that output is measured by the amount of hours you are standing in front of the conveyor belt, putting a screw in a car or whatever the hell it could be. What I'm worried about is, can everyone transition towards that new meaningful work environment? I would love to see that, but I'm afraid of the implications.
Look, I mean, it's like changes. It was like the Industrial Revolution, right? It like threw off a whole bunch of industries. Like, a lot of people lost their job. Like, there was enormous impact on society, but then society adapts. I'm not saying it's going to be a comfortable change. It's definitely going to be one that stings, and it's going to sting a lot. And we're already seeing the, let's say, like, the growing pains of the change that we're making. And it's why the world's kind of like, I won't say going to shit, but there's a lot of stuff going on right now. There's definitely a lot of things going on right now, because the world's just simply not ready in the way that it should be for this kind of change. But honestly, I think there are so many incredibly intelligent people and so many like caring people who will make the change in the best way possible, with as much consideration for others as is humanly possible. I really do think, and I really do believe, there are people out there like that. I think, for example, like the climate change movement, I see people all the time who are really sacrificing a lot for it. you know, and I'm not going to be the best advocate of climate change. It's something I absolutely believe, but I'm definitely not the example of like, hey, do what I do to like protect the climate. But I think there are some people that we definitely need to like applaud for how much they're giving to that. And I think it's the same with science, for example, like, you know, all this coronavirus stuff, there was that doctor in China who died, the whistleblower, like those guys, those people who, you know, give away everything sometimes to, you know, like move us forward, to tell us what's going on, to, you know, like reveal a certain way of the world just so that we can improve it. Not even necessarily to, you know, like freak out the world or anything, but it is a case of you need to know this. And sometimes it's you need to change this in this way. And I'm looking forward to seeing who the next person like that is. I think Elon Musk, for example, is a great case of someone who's really pursuing, you know, change. I don't necessarily agree with all of his methods all the time, and I've heard some pretty horrific things about, you know, how much he works people to the ground.
Yeah.
But he is, you can't deny that he is really pushing an agenda for change, which is very positive and very encouraging for the way that we want to take the world. Yeah.
He's pretty out there on the radical change spectrum.
Like all these guys need to be mad, right? Like, you know, it's like also like women leaders as well. Like they don't need to be mad, but they do need to show some charisma, and they do need to show like an entirely new, different way of thinking. And I'm so glad to see more of that. That it's definitely out there. It's definitely something that's more and more talked about, and you're definitely seeing these kinds of leaders emerge. And I'm encouraged by it. I really look forward to seeing more women leaders out there.
Yeah, I know. Me too. I've seen a few cases where it's a different dynamic in that position, and it's refreshing. It's not only refreshing, it also humbles me in a way where there are such powerful women leaders with principles and values that we have long forgotten. As in, like, instead of, you know, creating and scaling a company to the point where you are increasing revenue all the time at the cost of certain business practices, or actually questioning ethics or anything of that sort, and replace someone with that kind of mindset, and all of a sudden you have a brand.
But
that
in this
you
case, for me, it's like, let's not peg that down just to like the gender. But what I will say is that, as you said, like it is refreshing because it is an entirely different way of approaching a company, specifically when you've seen how much bias there is, how much like how many quagmires you have to go through, how much shit you have to deal with to like manage a day to day, and suddenly you have someone who's lived it. It's the same thing as like, you know, Barack Obama as the first black president. Like for a lot of people, that was a sudden revelation. Like, wow, this is possible. This is something that is like actually within reach. And because of that, it inspires so many other people to do great things. And that's why I think, look, even if there's a few leaders who make it to that level, they only inspire so many other people to do the same. So, and honestly, let's be real, I have a feeling that there's a couple of people in these very, very senior positions. Just retire, man. Just let it go. Like, you've made the money, you've made the success, you've made the dreams happen. Like, you need to have that change. Like, it just needs to be done, that you give that space to other people.
But it does bring up a point that you brought up before. Finding meaning in your work. What if their meaning involves staying in that kind of position?
But look, that's also kind of ignorant, right? Because it's the same thing as not listening to other people. Is they got to their positions by doing like admittedly great things. Like, I can't deny that, and I won't take that away from that.
Yeah.
But they are also reliant on so many people. They're reliant on every individual who contributes in their own way, you know, like the high performers, the people who stay late, you know, the people who like give everything that they have to these organizations. If you do not acknowledge that, then you know, all of that success is for you. Like, it's for me. Like, oh yeah, I'm great. But what about all these people who are doing exactly the same for you? And I think to shudder that because you think you have all the answers, particularly after a tenured career of, you know, 30 odd years, 35 odd years, like, you know, change is good. I think it's great to have that. And it's why I'm really encouraged, for example, I don't know if you've heard of this idea of having a shadow board, which is basically having like, it's like having your C-suite board,
yeah,
but just in a more junior position. So it's like student council, basically. But basically what they do is they give the opportunity to younger, like more junior employees to essentially make calls in the same way that the C-suite would, but from their perspective. So you have another level that just connects the C-suite to the lower management and the lower like employees. Because how are you ever going to get that perspective from, you know, on high? It's just never going to happen.
Is there going to be any implications on that? Because it sounds like the senior board can just overwhelm or veto any of the decisions
They can. But again, it's the same thing, right? Of listening. Like, if there is an overwhelming business case and you're dismissing it, who does that reflect badly on? No, I do say in the end, like, make sure you have your evidence. Make sure you've, like, thought about your argument and make sure you've, like, crafted it in the right way. But if a sound business idea comes up, saying no to it because you're stubborn and because you're, like, only interested in furthering your own goals, you know? Yeah, I mean, it's a simplified way of looking at the world, but either way, I do genuinely think that putting yourself in that position to understand what the rest of the company thinks rather than just what here and above thinks makes an enormous difference.
Yeah, of course. I've seen a few different ways to tackle that. It's because of, mainly because of the hierarchy of information and responsibility. The way that some, I believe it's some international relations teams have looked at it is there's one French theory of trying to tackle inclusion. So pretty much every decision made in the community, it may not apply to a company, but at least in the community, like a village or a town, has representatives or entities from all forms of the vertical hierarchy. So mm-hmm. from the common person to maybe nonprofit boards to all the way to C-suite, and everyone is equal at that. It's even something that sounds common sense. It sounds like it's common sense to have something like that. Even that can be considered radical in terms of change, because it's change in decision-making dynamics.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
And it'll be very difficult for, well, I mean, it's not difficult for many people to accept it, but not everyone will. I want to see, of course, I want to see more of that happen, ideally, but, you know.
Yeah, but again, I think that's the biggest challenge of our time is, can I convince you to change your mind? Can I convince you to think you're wrong? Because I think a lot of people nowadays don't want to be wrong.
Why?
Or like, I think it's because there's an embarrassment to feeling wrong, right?
Yeah.
That if you believe in something with all your heart and soul, and it turns out to be completely nonsense, or turns out that you've like spent a lot of your time pushing a case which simply can't be true, are you really willing to accept the consequences that come with that? I mean, there's a great case. I don't know if you know Leon Festinger. So he's like a social scientist. And like somewhere in the 50s, he did this amazing paper where he snuck into kind of like a cult group that was waiting for the end of the world. And so they couldn't wear any metal and it was just chaos and all this stuff. And they're like trying to make sure that nobody has any metal on them. They find out some guy has his zipper still on. So they like literally like cut out in panic this zipper to make sure that they all, as you can imagine, he's waiting for the hour to see what happens when these people realize that what they've been believing for so long is fake.
Mm.
So the time clocks, all these people are freaking out. They're like, oh, we're going to be saved by these aliens. The time ticks 12. Nothing happens. And some of these people are like, oh, yeah, like we have to tell the world that we were saved because we, you know, did all this work. It's like, yeah, you're justifying your belief and you're going deeper and deeper into the hole. Simply because you're not ready to accept the consequences of admitting that you're wrong. I mean, it's probably the same thing with like flat Earth, and it's the same thing with I don't know, like the two ends of the like political spectrum, or you know, like science and research or whatever. Like it can be big or small issues, but in the end, it's that idea of like dialogue and being like, hey, look, actually, that's a really fair point. I hadn't thought of that before. Cool. It's the same thing with like, you know, like some of the new genders that you hear and all of that. I like struggle to understand it because, you know, I've never grown up around, you know, all these different genders and this idea of, you know, like changing gender and all that stuff.
Mm.
But that means that it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, or it doesn't mean that it's like totally wrong, or it doesn't mean anything like that. It just means that I need to be open-minded enough to understand the arguments that they pose, the like the cases, the like way of life, the thought process, like all of those things need to go into my thinking. Because the moment that I just shutter myself out and say, hey, you know what, I don't really want to learn about this, is the moment that we're lost. Like there's no way forward from there.
Yeah, it came up to me as well, like the rise of a gender spectrum specifically. Okay. Like having different labels that define part of your gender identity, whether you are cis or trans or identify as male, female, or such.
But I think it's great. Interesting. I think it's fantastic. Mm. I think the only problem that it has now is the growing pains that it has, like most change has, which is how does it become accepted and how does it become something that you don't, I don't want to say you don't force onto other people, but you also don't like that it becomes a joy to see you happy in that way, rather becoming like a forced thing that everybody must adhere to and is like very, very difficult to come to terms with. I mean, I say that from a perspective of not knowing, but I would be super open to, you know, like seeing these people happy and to express themselves in the way that they truly feel. And I want to be like accepting of that. And that's the challenge. It's like, how can you convince someone different to that of how difficult that decision is and how much courage and how much like, you know, self-confidence it takes to finally get to that point where you can say, hey, I'm different, or I'm, you know, like I'm different than what's considered to be, let's say, like the standard dual gender.
That feeling of feeling that feeling different part is fascinating to me, and I think you can relate to this. I'm not talking specifically about gender, but when you are put into a context where you are either alienated or feel that you don't belong by being in different cultures. So let's go back a couple of decades, right? That both of us met in Holland in, I don't know, when you went to senior school, it was like 05 or 06. I think it's 06. And yeah, it was 06. Yeah, bloody hell, it's 14 years. Yeah. Because I came to Holland in 03. And then yeah. I was in the other junior school, the better one, because obviously we're number one. And we went to a senior school together. I'm curious to ask, since we were both not from Holland, we're not Dutch, right? Mm. You're Greek, I'm Malaysian, and we have lived in multiple cultures throughout our lives. How did it feel transitioning from culture to culture throughout the last few decades and feeling different in that regard?
I think the biggest challenge that I had was moving to England, because of the fact that I thought it would be easier than it was. I think I'd grown up in a culture which was quite open to seeing new perspectives and seeing people from all around the world. And, you know, we were so many nationalities all grouped together into one.
Yeah.
that it just seemed like a really easy switch waiting to happen. And I could not have been more wrong. It is different. And it's not like a, you know, criticism to them or like a criticism to me. It's that we had a different way of thinking, and it was very, very difficult for me to adjust in that I had a certain way of living, they had a certain way of living, and those things were simply not compatible in the way that we knew. I think since then I've noticed that my comfort still comes from people who are not necessarily lost, but more, I don't know, I don't want to say worldly, because that's a really like high-end term. because it's not that. Like, it's not that we're like, there's nothing better or worse about it. It's just a very, very different concept of how the world works.
Aware of, like, yeah, globally aware?
I'd say like globally aware, but it's more just that, like, it's just kind of an in-between space. It's an in-between space from, I'm from here, you're from there. It's like, okay, we're from somewhere. I can't really tell you where. I have this way of thinking that's like, not this, but not that. It's also the same thing that I had when I tried to like get closer to some of the Greek people, like being Greek, thinking, hey, cool. Like, this is a great chance to like connect with people that, you know, like my homeland and whatever and all that. Kind of and it just didn't work. Like, we just, it was this whole thing of like, hey, like, you speak really good Greek, but yeah, you're not from here. And even though, like, yeah, okay, I spoke loads of Greek at home, like, yeah, with my family, I used to speak Greek all the time, but the way that I acted and the things that I said just simply were not from there. But you can't class me as Dutch. You can't class me as English. Like, I'm somewhere, like, I mean, I would say normally, like, hey, look, I'm European, but that's also not really right. Mm. Like, I don't know. It's like the people who cover this in-between space, like, that's probably the best way that I can describe us.
Yeah, it's a lot of terms around there, around the world, to describe that. We have like third cultural kids, that term got replaced like recently, I think like 3 years ago, to cross-cultural kids. I like to call that the people who are everywhere but here.
Yeah.
Right? They have had a taste of many different cultures, many different forms of thinking, and many different principles of basically observing the world and how to react to them. And they have all culminated into this one being that is them, right? And therefore, you're not from, you know, you're not from Holland or you're not from England or anywhere. You just are, right? You're just from where you are right now in this moment. I was reading this one book. You probably know this. It's called The Courage to be Disliked. And
actually, I haven't read it, but I have heard of it before.
You have heard of it. It's really fascinating. It's a different way of writing a book. The whole book is a conversation.
Okay.
Yeah. The whole book is a conversation. It's not like, here's the main point, point one, point two, evidence one, evidence two. No, it's a talk between a philosopher and a student. And it's like a script. Okay. So it's like philosopher, da-da-da-da-da-da, student, da-da-da-da-da-da. And it's read like a script. So the words are more vernacular, as in you are, as if you are there at the table listening to the wisdom.
Okay.
They talked about that. They talk about a specific kind of philosophy. I forgot the actual name. I think it's like Adlerian psychology or something like that, or Jungian. And it was about defining all your issues with yourself as interpersonal relationship problems. As in, if you feel that your self-worth isn't that much, it is because you are comparing yourself to an ideal version, which is in a society where there are people, right? Therefore, to a certain extent, it's interpersonal. You'd have to look at yourself objectively, and then from there, start to love yourself, and therefore you thrive. And from another point of view, it was defining the past and how it has already happened, and therefore you are not who you were before. You are who you have defined now, and you are who you will be in the future, the choices that you make. So it's a lot of like redefining the meaning of choice, redefining the past, and lots of things.
Philosophy is always a heavy, heavy subject.
Yeah. I love it though. It's so complex and fascinating. Yeah. I really like it.
I only dipped my toes for the first time maybe this year, last year.
Okay.
And already it's one of those subjects that just like sucks you in, and then you realize that you know nothing. You like absolutely nothing. And there are these insanely wise people who have lived, you know, 100,000 years ago, who just just blows your mind that they could even come up with these kinds of things in their various time periods.
There's something interesting about this. People from thousands of years ago are saying quotes or phrases or epigrams or observations of the world that still apply today. Doesn't that blow your mind? It's insane to me, because we're talking about different cultural contexts, different levels of technological development, different trends in the world. And to the average person in that during that time, they don't know anything about the world. There wasn't any internet. So the world to them was like the village or something.
I mean,
like that.
Just think of it this way, right? Like, imagine 500 years ago, you find out like you can actually name gravity as a thing. Like, you just figure out that gravity is a thing. Like, to me, that's just completely mind blowing. It's also the same as, like, you know, like Da Vinci, for example. I was in a museum, like when I was visiting my sister in Milan, that you just see like the kinds of things that he was coming up with. It's like flying machines and tanks and like huge like contraptions that just seem like fucking outrageous. outrageous for a figure who was living like 500 years ago. And then, you know, even older than that, like the war machines, the like simple intelligence, the philosophers, like Marcus Aurelius and all of his thinking, like all that stuff is just like, oh my god, how are you thinking of this so long ago? Like, how did you have the wisdom that you would come up with something so timeless?
What's your favorite timeless wisdom?
That's a good question. Timeless wisdom. There was a story that I read in a book somewhere, which was, it was like two monks were on a journey. And so these monks had pledged that they would, that they were like not allowed to touch another, like a person or a woman. I can't remember exactly, but I think that was the case. And as they were on this journey, they stumbled upon someone who was like drowning in the river. And so like the older, like the master basically, just like obviously being the hero, jumped in, pulled this person out and carried them like to the next town, which meant that he had like given up his vow. And so he left him at this thing, and his student was there like, oh my God, you like, for so many years, you've like kept your vow. For so many years, you've kept your vow. And so for like, you know, a day or two that they're traveling, like the student is just there like, oh my God, like, why would you do this? Why would you like give up your vow so easily for this other person? And the master turns around and he says, yes, I may have given up my vow, but you're the one who's carrying the burden. Which is such a like, oh, like, yeah, you're carrying someone else's like choice. And that for me was a big thing. Like, don't, you know, people make their choices, like don't carry their weight for them. Like, you don't have to feel guilty for something that someone else did. Like, you're your own person and they're their own person. Like, choose for yourself, yes, but don't feel bad for other people.
Yeah, I like that story too. It's one of my favorites. Very powerful wisdom in like one page of words.
Yeah.
I really like that. There's one that I really like. There is a samurai that went to a monastery, and he wants to learn the meaning of heaven and hell. So he went up to a monk who's like, I think it's the master of the monk, and he says, can you show me the meaning of heaven and hell? I'm not sure if this is the right phrasing, but can you show me the meaning of heaven and hell? The first thing the monk does is insult him. He says, why should I show you anything? You're just a stupid samurai. You don't know anything, right? And in anger, the samurai took out his sword and he's like, how dare you insult me? I'm going to kill you, right? Like, you dare, like, threaten me or insult me or anything like that. And the very first thing the monk says after hearing that is, that is hell. And the samurai said, oh, okay. And he contemplated for a few seconds by himself. And in silence, he said, right, I reacted in anger. I'm sorry. And he sheaths his sword. And after that, the monk says, and that is heaven. Super powerful. Like can you imagine that when we barely, we in the world where we have a lot of evidence-backed rationality for a lot of decisions that we have to make, a lot of wisdom that we can find from many different blog posts or podcasts or videos all around the world now with all these different content mediums and all that. People from thousands of years ago would write stories for like 100 words, 200 words, 300 words. And it's not like they wrote it down and then it's like copywriting where it's like, oh, capture you with the first line and then hook you with the next one and then a clickbait title. It's a narrative. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. And the end is so impactful that you walk away 1% or 2% or whatever percent better than who you were before you read it. That kind of thing blows my mind. Like, honestly, like crazy. Oh my God.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think it's one of the big questions that I was reading about in philosophy, which is that boundary between losing what, like, you know, gaining all this efficiency, gaining all this like automation, getting this like drive for success. Mm. Again, it's that like, why? Like, what is this all for? Like, what is the meaning behind our existence? And why should constantly chasing for growth always be the answer? Why? Like, you know, there's no reason to like make music. Like, music is for connection. It's for like something more personal. Like, yeah, I can put my song through like a beat machine and make a science piece out of it and, you know, get like the perfect beat that, you know, is like satisfactory to a lot of people. But does it really connect in the same way as like something imperfect? And so you'll probably see, like, as automation increases, the market for imperfection will grow.
The market for imperfection will grow. Oh, yeah. That is interesting. Oh,
but I mean, think of it. Cool. It's like, why are vinyl still popular? Like, hey, like, you can stream sound whenever you want, but vinyl has that. That's something, you know? Or it's like, oh, hey, when I can just buy like a standardized IKEA table, you know, I can buy whatever table I want that looks exactly the same as the other one, or I can buy this like secondhand thing that actually has a story, that actually has like something cultivated in the background. Or it could be as simple as, hey, like, I wanted to read like a third, you know, a first edition copy of this book rather than a Kindle version of it because something about it feels more real. And you'll notice that rarity of imperfection will become more and more popular as it kind of dies out.
And imperfect marketing is always pretty fascinating. It's also about the copywriting behind it, right? Like how to capture someone from the very first few words. I was listening to this one podcast and they talked about a really interesting theory. You should probably look it up sometime. Maybe I'll pass you the link to the episode. It's only like, what, 10 minutes long. Actually, there should be a summary of it somewhere, but it talks about the reverse attention economy. So with the amount of information overload, people are starting to carve their own corner of the world where they have the choice of observing the world through a few specific pieces of content, whether it's a publication, whether it's a YouTube channel or a podcast show or whatever have you. A reverse attention economy is when creators would pay for consumers to look at their content. An example of this, right? So let's say I'm writing. So it sounds insane, right? It sounds insane. Okay. So here's the catch. There's a lot of subscription models for newsletters and for premium shows and all that. People are starting to define it that way, which means that you're going to have subscription fatigue. you're going to be paying for a certain amount of money per year, right? It's like a budget for consuming information so that you have less noise and you have greater value per consumed content, right? It's, for example, if it's your favorite writer or your favorite host or whatever have you. So that's going to be fatigued, which means that your attention has already been confirmed. Like, you will be looking at these because you have dedicated yourself to them. You have committed to them. That's normally via financial transaction. A reverse attention economy is when, say, I'm selling a book. I'm trying to get the attention of people who are already consuming all kinds of content. And yes, they are. And I'm willing to pay for their attention. The way that I would do that is that I would have my book online on Amazon or whatever. They would buy it. And because people have different levels of attention, the way that I would write the book is written in a way where a lot of the information is consumed, or a lot of the value or the wisdom is mainly in the first half of the book, and the second half is all the backed up evidence. And the catch is that I will pay you to read my book all the way until the end and give me a review. But first, you have to pay for my book first. And this will capture the people who would buy a book and then not finish it. And the only ones who would read it all the way into the end, give amazing feedback, would be the ones who actually gain money from it.
I don't know. I'm pretty skeptical about this idea because it involves paying someone else to exert effort on your behalf. And so you basically kill the joy of reading a book in that way to some degree.
It's the transaction part, the reverse transaction part happens at the end of the chain in which they receive value. So if even it works on top of someone like who would be purchasing a book anyway, right? Yeah. You just get an additional benefit if you are the kind of person who would read a book all the way until the end.
Yeah, but in the end, like, you take away the satisfaction of reading a book for the sake of reading a book. And literally what you're doing is you're paying someone to read your book.
Yeah,
and so that's an entirely different experience. It's the same thing as being like, you know, let me think of a good example. You drink coffee, right?
I'm drinking one right now. It's freaking 6:20 right now.
Yeah. Like, it's like the difference between you paying for a coffee because you want it for yourself and me paying you to drink my coffee.
Okay, yeah, I see. Like, I'm not drinking the coffee because I want to drink coffee. I'm drinking the coffee because I want to get paid.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Sort of like doing those online surveys and getting paid for it, right?
Like, yeah, it's exactly like that. And just think, like, the answers for those could be, like, completely questionable, right? Mm. But in most cases, I think that paying someone to do something is tantamount to ruining the entire experience because, you know, unless they're providing some kind of value and you're paying for them to do a service for you, I don't want to pay someone to do something that they should be enjoying anyways. Because it just means that what I'm doing is just not good enough on its own. Like, I'm not writing a good enough book for you to justify reading it. And then if you're so attention drained, then surely the question then turns to these people and it's like, is there no way to be more selective in the way that you use your time? Because you can't learn everything, let's be real. Like, as much as we all wish that we could learn everything, it's not
possible. I wish all the time.
And so sometimes that's exactly where we need to go, is accepting that we can't know everything and we can't learn, you know. Suddenly that frees up a lot of time. It's like, hey, look, if I selectively started choosing what I wanted to read or what I wanted to learn or what I wanted to do, you make time for yourself to focus on that one thing and you become very, very good at that one thing. And I think it's like what Gary Vee says a lot of the time, which is like, focus on your strengths, right? And you can't be the best at everything. And it's also unrealistic to think you'll be like the most knowledgeable person in the world. So focus your attention on the things that matter. I mean, read widely in the sense of keep your mind open, but also don't, you know, you don't have to get paid to read books. Like, you have better things to do with your time. I mean, like, how much do you value your time? Let's put it that way.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we all have to value our time so preciously, right? Like each and every second and every minute and hour, especially in a world where the pace is, the pace of everyday life is now driven by the happenings of the world, especially when we're so, it's so easily accessible just from a smartphone. Like, I like to think of this as like online and offline time. Like, to slow down, put your phone away, and then to get up to speed or to work, right? Turn on your smartphone. You're either working or you're a consumer of some sort, or you're selling part of yourself. So, right. We are coming up on time. I didn't actually have a set time, to be honest. Oh. Right. We went full on. So I don't give a shit. I'll try not to edit this too much, but I do want to, it's just first three episodes of a show. Fuck it. I have one question. Well, I have to test it out, but I want to articulate it a little bit. Say we walk away from this conversation and I meet someone that is so interesting, and part of the conversation, I impart some wisdom from myself to him that I, or him or her, that I've learned from you. What would that wisdom be?
Care.
Care.
I'm completely honest, is like actually take the time to show interest in the things that you love, in the things that you want to do, in other people. The more that you can show that, the more purpose you'll get out of it. Or the more revealing it will be that actually it's something that you don't really care that much about and you should be focusing on something else anyways. So take the time to care about things.
All right. And I guess we could end, well, the recorded part on there. Okay. Yanis, thank you so much. Where can we find you if we want to reach out to you in your social media
absolutely
links?
Absolutely, reach out to me on LinkedIn. Like, that's probably the best place to connect with me at the moment. And then otherwise, yeah, like through there, and then we'll find other ways to get in touch, but that's the best place to reach out to me.
All right. And I'll put your LinkedIn profile in the show notes right below this episode. Thank you so much.
Cool.
And I will talk to you soon London.
Cool.
And that is it. My talk with Yanis Dimitrilas. We talked about so many different things. It's really amazing to hear his side as someone who introspects a lot, someone who really does do some major self-reflection on himself, making the plunge to different cultures and countries, and hearing his thoughts on many different things. And I hope you enjoyed it. As always, you can always reach out to Yanis in the show notes below. His LinkedIn profile is there for you, and he is just a message away. So if you really enjoyed this episode, reach out to him and say thank you. And yeah, that's it. Without further ado, stay warm, stay lovely, and I'll see you in the next episode. Your foolish friend, Norm. Thank you for listening to the show. Anti-Fool is hosted, produced, and edited by me, Norman Cella. You can find out more about the show at thatsthenorm.com/antifool. It's where I host all my other podcast shows and more. The music and sound effects come from zapsplat.com. If you have any questions, recommendations for guests, and more, hit me up on Twitter at Normancella or on LinkedIn as well. There is only one of me in the world. I'm sure you can find me there. I love connecting with people and having warm, meaningful conversations. Don't be foolish, all right? Cheers.